Hope everybody is doing their best right now as we're going through this crazy time in our world. I'm Tony Bruschi, host of Real Ghost Stories Online. I wanted to invite you and let you know about our other brand new podcast that we just launched, Help Kill the Time for You. It's called The Dark Side of Wikipedia. It's about true crime and dark history. We dive into some of the strangest, most disturbed minds and experiences from our history and examine their story, their Wikipedia entry, and then discuss the cases, the individuals, and the psychology of the events as we go through each and every story. Some of our first episodes include Ed Gein, the BTK killer, the New London school explosion, Amityville murders, Richard Speck, Amelia Dyer, the General Slocum disaster, Jeffrey Dahmer, and more. New episodes every single week. Check out Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search it. Subscribe wherever you download podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and more. It's available now with new episodes every single week. Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search and subscribe today and stay safe out there. What happens when five members of the same family are murdered and the patriarch of the family disappears? Was the patriarch responsible for the deaths, or are they a victim too, held captive in a faraway location? Today we investigate the dark story of the DuPont de Ligonnès murders on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The DuPont de Ligonnès murders and disappearance involved the murders of five members of the same family in France, followed by the disappearance of the patriarch of the family, Xavier DuPont de Ligonnès, his wife, Agnès DuPont de Ligonnès, and their four children, who were murdered in an undetermined date in early April 2011. And their bodies found buried in their garden on the 21st of April. Xavier disappeared at the same time and has never been found. The exact nature of the events have never been determined, but Xavier is the subject of an international arrest warrant and is considered the prime suspect in the murders. The DuPont de Ligonnès family is an old French aristocratic family originally from Annonay. In the Bavarian region of southeastern France. Their ancestors include many well-known aristocratic families. In 2011, Xavier and Agnès lived at 55 Boulevard Robert Schumann in Nantes, Le Loire, Antique, in the modest house in the western suburbs of the city. Xavier Pierre Marie DuPont de Ligonnès is the son of Bernard Hubert DuPont de Ligonnès, an engineer with a degree from the École Nationale University. His mother was also a professor. Their activities were very vague, but he's described as a salesman by a source close to the inquiry. Xavier created several businesses with limited success, most of which catered to traveling salespeople and restaurant guests. One business based in Poinc, called Selvrief, had a secretive and ambiguously defined purpose. The company's 2006 accounts, accessible through a public commercial website, only show the bare minimum information, and the last data pertaining to the company was filed with the French Register of Commerce on the 24th of February 2004. As manager of the company, Xavier hired six salespeople in 2003 and released them all shortly afterwards. Agnes Hodanger was born on the 9th of November, 1962, in the suburbs of Paris. She was an assistant at a Catholic school, where part of her duties involved teaching catechism. She was described as being very religious, regularly attending Mass with her children. Parishioners described her as being kind but strict with her children. She was 48 years of age at the time of her death. In 2004, 7 years before the murder, she wrote prolifically on the French online medical forum Doctissimo. Agnes described the difficulty she and her husband faced and stated he had commented to her that a group death as a family would not be a catastrophe. The children, Arthur Nicholas DuPont de Leganese, was born on the 7th of July, 1990, to another father, but was recognized by Xavier as being his son when he married Agnes when Arthur was 2 years old. He earned a bachelor's in science, industrial technology, and sustainable development at the age of 20. He was studying for a technical diploma at IT and the St. Gabriel Private College at St. Laurent, an hour's drive from where he lived. He was also employed as a waiter at a pizzeria. He was 20 years old at the time of his death. Thomas DuPont de Leganese was born on the 28th of August, 1992, in the south of France. He earned a Bachelor of Literature when he was 17. He was passionate about music and studied it at the Catholic University of the West. He lived in St. Aubin Hall of Residence, and was described as an ordinary boy who was often accompanied by his family to drop him off and pick him up. While several of his classmates remember him as very discreet, he was 18 years old at the time of his death. Anne DuPont de Leganese was born on the 2nd of August, 1994. She was in the 11th grade following an academic curriculum in science and was described by her friends and relatives as a girl who shared her mother's religious beliefs and was considerate and approachable. Her friends became concerned when she was regularly offline and did not answer calls. Anne was 16 years old at the time of her death. Benoit DuPont de Leganese was born on the 29th of May, 1997, Xavier and Agnes's youngest child. According to his friends and secondary school classmates, he was popular and many girls fancied him. He was an altar server at St. Felix Church. He was 13 years old at the time of his passing. So this is an interesting case. I've heard a lot of buzz about it. If you're going, that sounds familiar, well, then chances are you've watched a little bit of Unsolved Mysteries this new season on Netflix. This is one of the episodes that investigates this story. It's the one with all the subtitles and the one that I have not watched it in its entirety yet because I hate subtitles. I usually, when I'm working during the day, I have something on one of my computers in the background, and I can't read subtitles while I'm working. So that's why I haven't really gotten into it. But it does look like a very fascinating case. I'm excited to jump into it and learn about it today. On the dark side of Wikipedia, Sean Reed joining us as a co-host today. Welcome to the program. Any familiarity with this case?
You know, I thought when we're recording this, we're under a international travel ban. So it's very interesting that we go international of a case to look at. Well done.
Ooh, we're going overseas. And I mean, the story, just the brief of it is like five kids die and then there's the patriarch of the family's missing and it's just dark and there's a lot of words that are hard to describe or hard to enunciate.
And really the toughest question you have to ask yourself, is it Xavier or ex-Xavier?
I think I said it two different ways there in the first couple titles. I go with Xavier. I think I guess it's a matter of personal preference, but I'm going to say Xavier for the sake of this episode.
And answer your initial question, yes, there was a little bit of this that I remember, not so in the detail that we're talking. What I find very interesting is we're just getting to know how Xavier or ex-Xavier, the father, uttered to the mother that a group death as a family would not be a catastrophe. Excuse me? Wait, honey, did we get eggs this morning at the grocery store? Yep, got the eggs, got some soy milk. Oh, and by the way, a group death as a family, well, it wouldn't be a catastrophe. It's not like I'm going to kill the family or anything, but it wouldn't be that bad.
It would be okay. Everyone would be fine. It's not exactly, yeah. Hey, can you pack, do we get orange juice today? Yeah, what, honey, what about that group death thing you just said? Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be a big deal. Did you get more Nutella? Because I think we were running low. I don't know how that was delivered. That would be interesting. The context of that conversation would be very interesting to fully understand. And because I don't think there's really any context in which that would be an acceptable phrase to use. the group death of your family.
Well, it's very interesting when we learn about all these stories and we understand and believe that much of the accounts and what happened is true. There's no reason that things are to be made up. But some of these facts that we read, how the hell does that translate from being said to a person who is no longer alive and then makes its way to the Wikipedia page?
Yeah. It takes quite a case, I've discovered, to get a good big Wikipedia entry, and this is quite a large one for a single family. But it's obviously five people are dead, and it's still an active mystery and case. I'm kind of excited to see what Unsolved Mysteries does in terms of it solving mysteries this time around. On Netflix, because they focus the full hour on one specific case. And this is the first time Unsolved Mysteries has existed with such a, with number one, new cases, and number two, with social media and our world being more connected than it ever was when it originally aired. So I'm very curious to see is when something like this gets thrown out there. You have every amateur Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys as an adult just in their passing time trying to solve these mysteries and digging into shit and trying to find records and things like that. So the ability for the average individual to actually, maybe you could solve a mystery, is very, very powerful today as opposed to what it was in 1989 on that version of Unsolved Mysteries. I've actually played with the concept once of bringing back the cases of unsolved mysteries that were unsolved in the 80s when it originally aired and seeing what we can find on those as a podcast where we revisit unsolved mysteries of the 80s and just kind of see where things are at. But alas, I would need a staff for that. And it would take a lot of research and a lot of work to dig into cases that have been closed for over 20 years. And then to find anybody that's willing to talk or even alive to talk in some cases. But I'm going to just kind of find some of these stories and talk about them here on Dark Side of Wikipedia. Let's continue on with this dark case of the DuPont de Leganés murders. This is the family's ending timeline and their final actions. The lease on the house had been terminated. All bank accounts had been closed. The children's school received a final payment settlement. Agnes's employer was informed that she was suffering from an issue and then that she was going to be moving to Australia. A message was placed on a letterbox, "Please return all correspondence to the sender. Thank you." The house had been completely emptied. In March of 2011, rifle bullets were purchased. Xavier registered the Charles de Jaminares shooting range and the north of the Nats, where he visited four times between the 26th of March and April 1st. He obtained a firearms license on the 2nd of February 2011. Thomas and Benoit had started to learn how to shoot while Arthur was scheduled to start. A sales receipt from a DIY store was found at the family home. The store is located in Saint-Maur in the central French department of Indre, approximately 320 kilometers from Nantes, so 3.5-hour drive away. The receipt was dated on a Wednesday in late March, either the 23rd or the 30th, and listed several purchases, including a roll of large bin liners and a box of adhesive plastic paving slabs. In April of 2011, Friday the 1st of April, Arthur, the oldest child, leaves college where he was studying and does not turn up at the pizzeria where he worked and was due to go to pick up his monthly wages. His boss was surprised by this, stating that Arthur always came to collect his wages on the first day of the month. Xavier DuPont was buying cement, a shovel, and a hoe. On Saturday, the 2nd of April, Xavier buys 4 bags of lime, 10 kilograms each, from different shops in the Nanette area. On Sunday, April 3rd, a neighbor, Fabrice, sees Agnes for the last time. Shortly afterwards, he sees Xavier putting large bags into his car. The couple and 3 of the children dine at a restaurant in Annette and then go to the cinema. At 10:37 p.m., Xavier leaves a message on his sister Christine's answering phone. "We spent our Sunday evening in the cinema together, then in a restaurant. We've just got back. I'm just calling to ask if it's too late to speak to you on the phone, and now I see it's gone to voicemail. But I was surprised you spoke to me about Bertram, who's getting ready for his flight, huh? But I thought he'd only just arrived. So I was a bit surprised. Anyway, sending you my love. If it's not too late, call me back or send me a text and I'll call you. Okay, I'm going to put the kids to bed. Say hi to everyone. See you soon. Maybe." The recording of the actual message was released publicly in September of 2019. On Monday, the 4th of April, Anne and Benoit do not turn up to their local school due to illness. Anne and Benoit's friends become concerned when they are unable to reach them. They remember a rumor about the family leaving for Australia, where their father had been given a job transfer, and they find it suspicious that their friends hadn't told them about this departure. They attempt to contact Benoit and Anne online and by text. Xavier speaks with his sister, Christine, on the telephone for 20 to 30 minutes. She said that everything seemed normal. Xavier dines alone with his son, Thomas, at La Croix Cadu, a high-end restaurant. The pair arrived at about 9 p.m. Xavier ordered a $35 tasting menu with half a bottle of red wine. Thomas had a sea bass dish and a tomato juice. The total bill came to £72.55. The two waiters remember Thomas feeling unwell near the end of the meal, and that Xavier and Thomas barely spoke to each other during the meal. Investigators believe that Xavier DuPont murdered his wife and 3 of his children on the night of the 3rd to the 4th of April, then murdered his son Thomas on the evening of the 4th of April. On Tuesday, April 5th, a bailiff comes to the family home to recover a debt of $20,000, but no one answers the door. The family's neighbors dispute Agnes's stated date of death. They've claimed that she was seen in front of her house on the 5th of April around 12:15 or 12:30, and again on the 7th of April. The prosecutor and Annette acknowledged that forensic experts were unable to narrow the exact date of death down to a specific day. In addition, an employee of a hairdressing salon near the house claimed on RTL to have seen Agnes on Tuesday, the 5th of April. The employee stated, "I came to pick up my wages. It was Tuesday, the 5th. I needed my wages. I saw her on the pavement on her phone at around 12:15 or 12:30. A friend of Thomas who studied music with him confirmed that Thomas spent Tuesday afternoon with him at the friend's home in Angers, where they played music and watched television. Thomas had planned to spend the night at his friend's house, but Xavier phoned his son asking him to return, and his mother had been involved in a cycling accident. Thomas ate quickly with his friend, then took a train home around 10 p.m. Following day, the friend tried to reach Thomas, but only received a brief text message in reply, such as, "I'm not coming to yours, I'm ill. Really ill. I'm not coming to class." 2 days after Thomas's departure, his friend received a text, "I'm out of battery. My dad's looking for a new charger for me." This is the last that Thomas's friend heard from him or anyone else in the family. Pauline, Thomas's ex-girlfriend and classmates, remembers him as a lighthearted, cheerful, and happy guy. She stated that they didn't date for long and described her ex-boyfriend as a really nice guy who always listened to what you had to say, very close to his brother, sister, mother, and father. Passionate about music and cinema. She also stated that she had spoken to him on Facebook on Tuesday, the 5th of April, while he was at his friend's house, and that he had seemed odd in his way of writing. When he told her his father had told him his mother had been in a cycling accident and that Thomas had to return home that same evening. Furthermore, the day before, she had noticed that he seemed lonely and had told her that he would skip classes on Wednesday to come to a music rehearsal, but he did not turn up at the rehearsal, which was not like him. During this week, neighbors heard the family dogs howling for two consecutive nights and then never heard them again. On Wednesday, April 6, Arthur's girlfriend, who is concerned after not having heard from him, knocks on the door for the family home where a light was on the first floor, but the family's two Labradors did not bark when she knocks. On April 7, several witnesses claim to have seen Agnes alive. Xavier is seen making several return trips from his house to his car, loading the car with large bags. A neighbor also claims to have spoken to Agnes on this day, on the 7th of April. I saw Agnes walking her dog. We spoke briefly. Then I cut our chat short because I had an important appointment. The same neighbor spoke to RTL in condition of anonymity, saying, the newspapers say the autopsies put her death on the 4th of April, but I'm almost convinced I saw her on the evening of Thursday the 7th because I know I didn't have much time to speak to her as I picked up my son from the childminder every Thursday evening. A report by Anne Sophie Martin in a newspaper, which was on a television station, which was broadcast on Channel France 2 on the 24th of October 2013, stated that more than 2 years after the events, this neighbor was still convinced that she saw Agnes on the 7th. The report revealed another witness who agreed with this, a saleswoman friend of Agnes, who stated that she saw her in the shop on either Thursday the 7th or Friday the 8th of April. On Friday, April 8th, Xavier writes on the Catholic online forum, site Catholic.org, according to the state prosecutor, he went online for the last time on the 8th of April from an IP address of the family home. He sends an email to his brother-in-law, Christine's husband, saying, everything's fine, Bertram. You'll hear more detailed news soon through Christine. Bye for now. All the best, Xavier. A message to Xavier's mother and sister is sent from the family's home IP address. After this was revealed by RTL and Lee Figaro on the 7th of May, the family's lawyer said it was sent from their IP address, but what if it was written under duress? Either Xavier killed himself or he was murdered. Disappearance and letters. On Monday, April 11th, Anne Benoit's school receives a letter signed by Xavier stating that Anne and Benoit will be leaving the school and the family will be moving to Australia due to urgent professional changes. The Catholic school where Agnes works received a resignation letter signed by Agnes stating the same reason for leaving. The headmaster is unable to reach her by telephone. A typed, unsigned letter dated 11th April, the date may have been added afterwards, is sent to Xavier's immediate family. This was revealed by the press on the 5th of May. In this letter, Xavier explains that after having worked covertly for the American Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, the entire family has had to relocate to the United States as part of a federal witness protection program that no one will be able to contact them for a few years. He advises his relatives to circulate reports on social media that the family has in fact moved to Australia. There's no proof that this letter was written by Xavier DuPont. To this day, results of DNA analysis, if any, are unknown. Xavier spends the night of the 11th to the 12th of April at a hotel near Toulouse in southern France and pays for his stay by credit card. He then leaves in his Citroën C5. On Tuesday, April 12th, Xavier spends the night of the 12th to the 13th at another hotel in southeastern France under the false name of Mr. Laurent Xavier. He pays $214.59 by credit card. On Wednesday, the 13th of April, neighbors in Nanats became concerned and contact the police. The house's shutters have been closed for more than a week, and Agnes's car has been parked outside the street the entire time. Xavier spends the night of the 13th to the 14th of April in a hotel at Lee Saint-Sormier in Var in southeastern France. He lived in the town in the 1980s. Former girlfriend from that time informed the police that Xavier had contacted her that evening, although they did not meet. On Thursday, April 14th, Xavier withdraws $30 from an ATM. That evening, Xavier sleeps at a hotel in the town where he's captured on film by a surveillance camera, the last known sighting of him. On Friday, April 15th, Xavier checks out of the hotel, abandoning his car there. So that's where we are so far in the story. Little bit suspicious. Your family seems to be missing. You're all alone, going from city to city, going further and further away from your place of residence. And nobody is seeing you with the family that apparently is moving with you. Thoughts thus far?
Yeah, that's a little sketchy. Also, telling wife's employer that they have to move to Australia, but then saying a different story regarding to come to the United States. Why the conflicting where we're going to go? I would just think, here, we'll have them pick up the scent in Australia, then we'll throw a curveball to the United States. I'm just going to let that marinate while I figure out what the heck my next move is, because yeah. I just killed my family. I don't really know what to do long term here. Yeah.
Hey, let's go to another city where maybe an old ex-girlfriend is and call her up. That to me is an interesting point where it's like, okay, so you pulled off this murder and you're going all around, but something in you thinks it's a good idea to get in contact with an ex-girlfriend in this different city while you're married, and supposedly your family, you're all moving to Australia, but hey, let's call that, I guess, is this like the prime example of when the stereotype is thrown at men of like, oh, you're thinking with your pants and not your brain? Is that, do you think that was the reason for that call?
You know what? You're having some marriage problems or you killed your family. Speaking as a male on planet Earth, there's never a time you're not going to check in with an ex-girlfriend when you're going through a tough time in your life.
It's one of those things where I want, you know, it ends up being, I think, somewhat of a key piece of evidence showing, yeah, I mean, this is from someone that, you know, can be identified in another place at another time beyond just a credit card statement or something like that. Would have been interesting had she actually met up with him to see state of mind. What was he thinking? What was he, you know, what was he up to? What was he like that night? Was he just out for a, you know, going to get some from an ex-girlfriend, or is he, you know, did he want to talk? Was he breaking down? There's a lot of ways that could have played out. I'm kind of curious, but.
And as a public service announcement, if you ever have somebody that reaches out to you that maybe you hadn't talked to since college or maybe a couple of years, and you think to yourself, why are they reaching out? Do they love me? Do they really want to get back together? We could have had that high school romance, and now we can later in life. You know what? He or she may very well have just committed a murder.
There's a couple options there. Either they're informing you of the disease that you have that they just found out that they had and have never told you about that. Guess what? You have a child that you didn't know about. Or they just killed their family. It's usually one of the three. It's not usually just, hey, let's go try the new Frappuccino at Starbucks. I heard it's really good. And we haven't spoken in all those years, but let's get together. I think it's unicorn flavored. Let's have it. That should be great.
I don't recognize this number. Hello? Hello? Yeah. Tony, how have you been? Yes, great, wonderful. Somebody wants to say hello. Hi, Mom. Who's that? That's your son. It's his 16th birthday party. I bought him a new car. You got to pay half. It's Sunday at 1 in the club room.
But I just killed my family. Great. Timing is great. You can join this one. Yeah. I don't think that's how it should go. Yeah. Let's continue on with more of this dark tale. On Tuesday, the 19th of April, an investigation was opened and revealed Xavier's purchase of the DIY materials. On Thursday, April 21st, a wanted notice is issued for the whole family. During the day, investigators discovered the remains of Agnes and the four children under the patio in the back garden of the house. The family's two Labrador dogs had also been killed and buried. During the night of the 21st to the 22nd of April, the metallic blue Citroen C5 with registration 235CJG44 is found in the car park of the Formula One Hotel by police equipped with an automatic number plate recognition system. The whereabouts of a Pontiac, which was also being sought, remained unknown to this day. Investigators turned toward a line of inquiry involving a monastery. It's speculated that Xavier DuPont could have withdrawn to a monastery where he would be afforded discretion, autopsies, funeral, and cremation. On the 22nd of April, autopsies, according to the autopsies, the victims were drugged and then shot dead with a .22 long rifle as they slept. Xavier has a weapon of this caliber, which he inherited from his father 3 weeks before the murders. The prosecutors in Annette states that he will allow the victims to be buried in the next few days. The surprising speed of this procedure, combined with the fact that relatives were advised not to view the bodies, leads Xavier's relatives to believe that these bodies recovered are not those of Agnes and her children. An international arrest warrant is issued to locate Xavier DuPont in order to obtain witness testimony from him with regard to the murders. The family's funeral was held at 2:30 p.m. at St. Felix Church in Annette. The DuPont de Ligonnès family regularly attended the church, and Benoit was an altar server there. 1,400 people attended the funeral. The family requested a simple ceremony with neither flowers nor wreaths. Significant security was provided for the event. The bodies were cremated after the funeral. The victims were buried on Saturday, the 30th of April at 10:30 a.m. in eastern central France, the place of origin of Agnes's family. On the 29th of April, a search was carried out in the Var department. On the 10th of May, an international arrest warrant was issued for Xavier DuPont. On the 23rd of June, caving experts searched 40 natural caves in a 15-kilometer radius around the area. Following the disappearance of Xavier DuPont, and based on elements of the police investigation reported by the media, hundreds of French internet users, fascinated by this curious crime, became improvised cyber investigators and gained great excitement from recreating every digital trace left by Agnes and Xavier on Facebook. According to an AFP press release, in Le Monde, administrators of a Catholic website classified by as fundamentalist by the church confirmed that Xavier DuPont was a member of their forum, where in 2010 he asked about the meaning of sacrifice, and he recently became aggressive. Xavier was involved in various theological discussions under several different online identities on the Christian forum Le Site Catholique. He was eventually banned from the forum. According to a source close to Xavier, he never set a foot inside a church. A study published by Bernard Belande about religious movements and later put online states that if Xavier is the murderer, his motives were not religious. The investigation has been running since 2011 and has led to more than 800 tips as well as searches that have led to dead ends. Before his disappearance, Xavier DuPont attempted to make contact with several old friends. The police in Annette, under the orders of Judge Robert Tachlin, spent more than 2 years looking for Claudia, a German woman whom Xavier almost married in the early 80s and with whom he had kept in contact. On the 27th of February 2013, German police had planned to launch an appeal for witnesses on the German program Case Number XY Unsolved on the German public channel ZDF. The appeal was abandoned when Xavier's sister and brother-in-law noticed that the file included their email addresses. Contrary to Germany's very strict privacy laws, according to French prosecutor Bridget Lamy, information from Germany was handed to French investigators on the 16th of April 2013, but added nothing to the file. American investigation, Xavier DuPont and created NetSurf Concept LLC, which is a company that was recorded on the commercial register in Florida. His advisor was Gerard Corona, a French immigrant and manager of the company Strategy Netcom, which was founded in 1998. Corona specializes in assisting foreigners with administrative and legal procedures in the United States. He also helps his clients to open foreign bank accounts and to obtain anonymous bank cards allowing them to withdraw money anywhere in the world without leaving a trace. It's been theorized that Xavier DuPont could have used these services in order to disappear. On the 9th of April 2013, an operation was conducted to find the body of Xavier DuPont. This led to a major search effort. Investigators assisted by cave divers searched the old Pickmartin lead mines in Kennet de Maurice in Var. It was here that Jacques Massy and his family were found murdered in 1981. On the 2nd of May 2013, a search was carried out by 50 police officers and firefighters from a unit specializing in searching in dangerous and hard-to-access locations. The search proved fruitless. Investigators' conclusions: the prosecutor, Bridget Lamy, had not recognized Xavier DuPont's status as a suspect and leans towards the belief that he committed suicide. If his body is found there and no other suspect, the investigation will be closed by default. In June of 2013, a body was found 20 kilometers from where Xavier DuPont was last seen. An autopsy was carried out and did not completely exclude the possibility of the body being that of Xavier. The prosecutor in Duraganan, Daniel Deroy Arel, stated, "At this moment in time, it is not the body of Xavier DuPont," without providing any more details to explain this declaration. On the evening of Tuesday, the 28th of April, 2015, a walker discovered bones in a forest on the south coast of France, close to where Xavier DuPont was last seen. The police made a link with Xavier's disappearance and analyzed what appeared to be a survival camp where other objects were discovered, including an empty wallet, a lighter, and a pair of glasses, a sleeping bag, magazine, and a bill dating from 2011. A medical pin was also allegedly found in the unknown descendant's forearm's bone. However, as far as the police are aware, Xavier DuPont did not have a medical device in his forearm, even though it's not impossible that he may have been operated on after his disappearance. The magazine that was found seems to date from 2010, preceding Xavier's disappearance in 2011. On the 1st of May 2015, the RTL French website reported that DNA obtained from the personal effects around the body discovered on the evening of the 28th of April is not that of Xavier, but that of another man whose identity is currently unknown. And in mid-July of 2015, an Annette journalist received a photograph on the back of which is a handwritten note. It reads, "I'm still alive." The picture shows two of the DuPont de Lanis children, Arthur, the oldest of Benoit, and the youngest, sitting at a kitchen table. It's not known who took or who sent the picture. On the 9th of January 2018, armed police raided the Saint Desert Monastery in the village where Xavier DuPont was last seen after several worshippers claimed that they had seen him there. Police initially struggled to make headway as monks at the monastery have taken a vow of silence. However, after 2.5 hour search, they determined that the reports were a case of mistaken identity and the person believed to be DuPont de Lanis was a monk who bore a resemblance to him. On the 11th of October 2019, a man was arrested at Glasgow Airport in Scotland after arriving on a flight from Paris, Charles de Gaulle Airport, following an advanced passenger information alert. Interpol in London had informed the French authorities on Friday the 11th of October that a passenger who was booked onto a Paris-Glasgow flight on the 12th of October had entered API details corresponding to a stolen French passport, suspecting that the passport may have been used by Xavier DuPont. The French authorities planned to be present at the boarding gate at Charles de Gaulle Airport for the Saturday flight to intercept the passenger and verify his identity. However, the passenger made a last-minute change to his flight booking, instead flying to Glasgow on the Friday evening. This was too late for the French authorities to go to the airport in Paris, so they asked their Scottish counterparts to intercept the passenger. Upon arrival in Glasgow, the passenger was duly arrested by police in Scotland, who fingerprinted him before telling the French authorities, "This is your man." This information was released to the media, and the story received blanket news coverage in France. However, in the meantime, the French authorities had studied CCTV images from Charles de Gaulle Airport and doubted that the man was DuPont. Their doubts were further raised when police in Scotland refused to send them the fingerprint results. On the 12th of October, following more thorough fingerprinting and a DNA test, it was announced that the arrested man was not Xavier Dupont de Leganés, but a 69-year-old Portuguese-born French nationalist visiting his Scottish wife in Dunoon. The man was released without charge. It was revealed that the man had reported his passport stolen in 2014, but had since acquired a valid, legitimate replacement passport and has been traveling on that passport regularly since then. Following this revelation, critics raised in France about how the media took for granted the official police statements. Immigration theory, even though Charles de Leganés initially doubted the authenticity of the letter from 11th of April 2011, while still claiming her brother's innocence, she began stating to the media in March 2012 that basically Xavier and his family left the United States, or left for the United States, because their safety was threatened in France. Their bodies found under the patio can't be those of Agnes and the children. She believes that the information leaked to the media originates from sources with an interest in making the family disappear. In 2013, in the blog that she created with her husband, Bertram de Verdun, she mentions an email that her brother wrote to friends in July of 2010. He wrote of accidents which may befall his family and ended with the words, "So I hope that even after a police investigation, my parents, brothers, and sisters will never be led to believe that I intentionally caused these accidents, even if the evidence is strong." According to Mr. Goldstein, the lawyer for Genevieve Dupont de Leganés, the suspect's mother, Christine, his sister, and Bertram, Christine's husbands, "We don't even know when the victims were killed. The autopsy points to a death between 10 and 21 days before the discovery. Such impression is truly astonishing. In reality, nothing is certain in this affair other than the fact that these bodies, or some bodies, were found at 55 Boulevard in Schumann. Investigations were carried out, but all that they have allowed us to ascertain is that the bodies share the same DNA. No analysis has compared this common DNA with that of Agnes. Furthermore, my client confirms that the body's heights and weights do not correspond to the known dimensions of the family members. In my opinion, this constitutes negligence during the autopsy, but the autopsies allow Christine and Genevieve to step into the breach. What I also know is that one man alone cannot dig that hole under the patio, even a man blinded by rage and hatred. 2.5 cubic meters of earth was displaced. The affair is based around an idea that Xavier Dupont killed his family before burying them. No other line of inquiry has been explored. I don't know who killed his family. Nothing about their lives would lead me to believe that anyone would have it in for them at this extent. That's the conclusion of my clients. Since no one could have killed them, the fact that they are not dead." Christine de Verdun also cites on her blog that the difficulties faced by a person burying five people underneath the guarded patio. She provides photographs of the niche where the bodies were discovered and states that the space is 1.2 meters, just under 4 feet high. Thus, the perpetrator would have to be working on their hands and knees without long tools, including a shovel and hoe purchased by Xavier soon before the murders. Christine also mentions that no displaced earth was found in the garden, in which case the perpetrator would have had to have used a tarpaulin, displaced 5 tons of earth by hand, and left absolutely no trace of this earth. Furthermore, Christine claims that Xavier had neck and back problems and would not have been able to physically or be capable of such a task. Finally, it is surmised that due to the low headroom, the perpetrator would likely have both banged their head and rubbed their hair on the ceiling repeatedly, but no human skin cells, blood, or DNA were found there. So it just keeps getting deeper and deeper and stranger and stranger, and the possibilities. I see why people were fascinated with this case. Thoughts so far?
I thought there was going to be an opportunity, and then another opportunity, where it would all come together, and then it wasn't. And it really makes you think how, as far as a police statement, you pretty much hold that as fact. But for them to confuse it with somebody who had a passport stolen a while back and he was just in Scotland visiting his wife, Is this the first time that we have read something where there has not been a concrete capture or sentence? This is, yes?
Maybe with you as the co-host. I think there's been one or two that we've done that were more historic cases. Okay. That were like from way, way, way back. But as far as like a somewhat present day thing, yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, so if Xavier, if you're listening to us,
maybe you can solve a mystery.
Email us, let us know where you are. We'd love to add to our conclusion of what you're doing.
And if you call right now, we're going to throw in 5 free rentals from Blockbuster, and get this, you're going to get 2 half off coupons for Shakey's. So
now here's the thing, Xavier. Excuse me, Xavier. If you call in the next 25 minutes, we're going to get you 4. We're going to double the opportunity because we do appreciate you.
Oh, my gosh.
You're elusive. You're an international man of mystery, and we want to hear you. We'll do a live Dark Side of Wikipedia. We're not going to have our listeners wait a little bit of time to download it. Good to be live. And that extra set of Shakey's 50% off coupons. So give us a call.
You know what? But it doesn't stop there. But wait, there's more. You are going to receive a free, not 50% off, a free 2-leg and thigh chicken dinner from Ma and Pa's Grocery Express in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, my hometown. It's a little, I don't even know if it exists anymore, but that used to be a prize I would give away on the radio. Caller 5 wins a 2-leg and thigh chicken dinner.
Okay, Xavier. So if you're right now, you've picked up your cordless and you're going to dial us, but you're thinking, no. There's more.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Here's what we're going to get you, Xavier. We're going to get you a compact disc. Okay. REO Speedwagon.
Ooh.
The Essentials.
Yes.
REO Speedwagon, The Essentials. And Xavier, because this is a little bit reflective. This is a part of history. This is going to have you bring back stories from your earlier life.
Yeah.
I'm going to get you something from my early life. I'm going to get you the first ever tape cassette I purchased and I listened to walking home from Jefferson Elementary in West Dallas, Wisconsin. Fine Young Cannibals.
Ooh, Fine
she
Young
drives
Cannibals.
Me crazy. Yeah, yeah.
Drives me crazy. Ooh, ooh. I'm going to throw in one more thing. One more thing, and then we'll stop there because wait, there's more. I am going to also, on a Maxwell cassette tape, I'm going to copy the greatest hits of Journey, but it's not the Steve Perry version of Journey. It's the Journey with the guy that sounds like Steve Perry. Their greatest hits. So it sounds pretty close to the originals, but it feels like there's something kind of off. So it's not quite as satisfying as hearing the original version of Eye of the Tiger, but you get pretty close. And that's going to be on a 90-minute, two-sided Maxwell cassette tape that has not been used since 1993. So if there's ever a reason to come forward, I don't think you can turn this offer down. So here's what I'm thinking, though. Seriously, I'm wondering, and maybe more will point to this as we get into some of the potential sightings. Could this be literally like a Walter White situation like there was on Breaking Bad? Not that he was making meth and then he needed to go hide, but more so from the DEA end of things. Is that part legit? I mean, if he was working covertly, almost as a spy or a DEA agent for the U.S., and he was, came across something, his whole family was under complete threat, and whoever found him, would be able to find him should he continue to use his name and his family use his name. Could this literally be a witness protection thing? And the family never died. There was nobody in those caskets. The government, arranged this with the French government saying, look, we got to make it a funeral. We got to do this. We got to do that. We have to really make these people look dead. And, there's enough little things that can go wrong in that, or that can be small red flags that everybody looks at and go, wait a second, this doesn't seem quite right. Where maybe they're living in Iowa and they're alpaca farmers now under the name, Joe and Jane Smith. I'm wondering if this is kind of what happened there with all of how the story is kind of playing out. I don't know that he's really a murderer, but we'll find out more as we continue on. What are your thoughts on that?
Short answer is yes. And I think it's a situation where none of us that are not in a government classified role do not know the lengths that some entities will go to make something go away or for the attention to be over here, but to then say, hey, look, a deer,
yeah,
and then run the other way. So short answer is yes. I think this is a situation where there is enough WTF-ery to it to really support a conspiracy theory of he really is what he is saying he is.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't ever think that there's going to be 100% in unison agreeance where he's 100% lying,
yeah,
or it is 100% factual. I think there's just so much clear as mud information here that you'll have your staunch, yes, he is undercover and he's living in Cleveland right now, or he's dead. He did kill his family. And 30 years from now, they'll finally eventually discover his body.
It's interesting. Let's continue on, because the next chapter here is about potential sightings. So I'm very interested to hear what and where people have supposedly seen either Xavier or members of the family. Police received more than 900 reports with people believing they had spotted Xavier. Most notably, someone matching his physical description was caught on a CCTV in a casino in Nerys Les Bains, and the police subsequently concentrated their search in the area. An unsigned letter dated the 11th of April 2011 purportedly from Xavier was received by Xavier's close relatives. The letter was released to the press on the 5th of May. It covers four pages of A4 size paper, is written in informal, sometimes humorous style, and at times rambles and goes off on unrelated tangents. It translates into English as follows. Hey everyone, huge surprise! We have to leave urgently for the U.S. due to a very particular set of circumstances that we will explain below. You're receiving this letter by conventional post because for the next few years we can't communicate any other way. No emails, no texts, no phone calls, for safety reasons. When you read this letter, we will no longer be in France and won't be able to return for an as yet undetermined period of time, a few years. You may be wondering, what's going on? Here's the story, at least as much as we're allowed to tell you. This letter is the only correspondence we were allowed to write, which might be good news for some of you, and it has been checked before being sent to you. When we started our company in Miami in 2003, we were put into contact through the person who helped us start the company with the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, a sort of American drug squad with agents on the ground in several countries who were looking for a French national to infiltrate the French nightclub scene to obtain information about drug trafficking and money laundering networks without drawing attention to themselves. Through the Route de Camoroux, I found myself in a different city every evening with a legitimate reason to make contact with nightclub bosses to invite them to be listed in the leisure section of the RDC. So I, Xavier, was the ideal candidate. So once I was tested and briefed, I accepted my mission of working incognito for the DEA under the condition that I maintain secrecy, which includes, even more importantly, the children. So that's the real reason why we returned to France instead of settling in Miami, and not due to vaccinations that are supposedly dangerous for children. Those who have never swallowed their bogus reason can rest assured they were right, LOL. This has allowed us to build up our official business activity. The RDC and SELREF, established especially to develop LarissaVitesis.com alongside RDC so that nightclubs can be featured in it. And to have an unofficial monthly income, since this official activity did not bring in enough money to cover our expenses. Far from it. Moreover, even with this cash boost, we have experienced temporary financial difficulties from time to time, as you all know, and we'd like to take this opportunity to once again thank Emmanuel and Bertram, who bailed us out in a timely manner by acting as our bankers. Everything has gone according to plan in the nightclubs for the last 7 years, until now. With the information that I, Xavier, have collected in this time, I have become a key witness in an upcoming trial involving major international drug trafficking kingpins. The trial will have to take place in the U.S. in the next few years. The date has not been determined. What complicates matters is that certain tips had recently led us to believe that my cover may have been blown. And unfortunately, we received confirmation of this yesterday. Therefore, the situation has now become potentially dangerous for us here and has required us to take emergency measures. When I first went undercover, I accepted that I might be placed into the Federal Witness Protection Program. This is what we now have to do, and we're not doing it with any excitement, but because it's necessary and there's no way around it. So we would have been taken into protective custody of the U.S. government and transferred to the U.S., and we now have new identities, which must, of course, be kept secret. By the time you read this letter, we will officially no longer exist as French citizens. We will be Lambada U.S. citizens, living in the U.S. like any other U.S. citizen, except we'll be forbidden from communicating with our family and friends for an undetermined period of time, at least until the trial is over. This gives us some advantages and disadvantages. Advantages: absolute safety, no reprisals to fear. The U.S. government is taking care of us financially. Living in the U.S., we can't tell you where, but the weather is warm most of the time and the music is good. Disadvantages: sudden rush departure in total secrecy without being able to put our affairs in order. No contact with you for a long time. Impossible to let everyone know. All electronic communications had to cease immediately. The hardest thing, there's some tension with the children who couldn't tell their friends and are forbidden from using Facebook or other online networks. But it's okay, really. They understand. We had to give up the dogs. Luckily, some took both of them so they won't be separated. We're relying on each of you to carry out the tasks that we had assigned to you below. We hope we haven't asked too much of you. We know we can count on you. 1. Cedric, come and remove whatever is left at the home by the 31st of May. The earlier the better. We started sorting through things and giving stuff away, clothing, etc., but we didn't have time to finish. We could have let the Americans sort everything out, but they're not very thorough and everything would have gotten lost. Prized furniture, musical instruments, cars. 70% of the stuff can be taken to the dump. All the beds, chests, drawers, storage boxes, trunks, etc. The furniture to keep is in the living room, plus the wardrobe that has been taken apart in Arthur's bedroom, and the desk in the laundry room. The rest can go to the dump. The nearest one is in Echo Point, 3 kilometers from the house. Open middays on Sundays. There's a redacted area. Except the boxes pertaining to Project Crystal, maps, tickets, etc., which need to be given to FM, full name redacted. Contact him by phone. Also accept the equipment to give back. The BIGOS router. The furniture to be kept should be given to Lucamalo, who will be waiting for it to be shipped to B, full name redacted, Agnes's brother. The house keys are hidden outside in the gas meter, which you can open with any tool, car key, screwdriver, etc. Note, some of the copies of the front door key are badly done, and you have to wiggle the key around in the lock to get the door to open. We were able to put everything we want to keep, and which we can by no means take with us, into a safe to find later, such as personal items, photos that might show a non-American life, souvenirs, computers, various pieces of paperwork, jewelry, weapons, etc. So you don't need to do any sorting. Just throw everything out or keep it for yourself if you want. Inform Aline and other friends of our departure. Sell the Gulf convertible. And Exnada. Signed paperwork is in the living room table. And send the money from the sale. Minus 20% commission for your service to Christine. Contact by her phone. Note, the C5 was unsellable, so it was given to the father of one of Arthur's friends for parts. Also, go to Arthur's and Thomas's places to do the same thing. The landlords are aware. The addresses and keys are on the living room table. Presents for Cedric to share with Renaud and other friends who lend a helping hand to thank you for your help. Table, football, piano, TV and other video equipment, CD, DVD collection, audio, videotapes, musical instruments, drum kit, guitar, piano, bass, plus some other things which anyone can take, fridge, tumble dryer, etc. P.S. No need to worry about the metal detector or the canoe, which can stay there, nor the rubble and other mess piled up on the terrace. At the end of the garden in the basement, that was all there when we moved in. Bertrand. Arrange with Cedric to recover and store the high-value furniture to be kept. They are Hodanger family heirlooms. Contact FG, full name redacted, to get crowbar display cabinet from her and to take other worthless furniture off her hands. Inform the Hodanger family. Redacted, redacted. Give the money from the sale of the display cabinet to Christine to share it with Vero. Keep the sales receipts from the furniture to cover the moving fees. Emmanuel, set up an appointment for a final inspection and inventory after the 31st of May with the P, full name redacted, agency and obtain the deposit and send it to Christine even if the amount is insignificant. Cancel the electricity, gas, telephone, water, internet, and water contracts. The paperwork is on the living room table. Tell our friends Michael, Mark, Ludo, etc. about our departure. FYI, all the letters addresses to our houses are being returned to sender. Ongoing matters will fall by the wayside as time goes by. Social Security and other personal or private matters. Christine and Bertram, manage the accounts according to the instructions in the document enclosed with this letter. More than $4,000 will be coming in every month to various accounts for a while, and the proceeds from the sale of the furniture mentioned above. Frederick, inform Veronique that and help her let the rest of the family know. Redacted, the best thing to do would be to send her a copy of this letter when she is in Versailles. Important, tell the youngsters not to divulge any information on Facebook and not to be surprised if the kids don't reply to them. If possible, pursue Project Crystal. This could be a good project for Arthur, Lietta's son, and maybe Edouard. And it would allow us to have a comfortable income when we return. The enclosed documents give an overview of the project. Contact Cedric and pick up the stock of maps and tickets. So that's it for the to-do list. The children's schools are aware, as are Arthur's and Thomas's landlords and Agnes's and Arthur's employers. The official story is that we have been transferred to Australia for work without providing any specific details. It would be good for you if you spread this false story on Facebook and elsewhere. We hope it doesn't drag on for too many years, but we're still anxious about how long the legal proceedings in the U.S. will take. In a while from now, we will be able to send you some information by post. We have designated Emmanuel as the central contact, as he has the advantage of knowing almost all of you. He will be the one who receives letters to be sent on to you. He will receive instructions in good time. Of course, we send all our love and are thinking of you very much during this enforced separation. Take care of yourselves. We'll have so many stories to tell you later on. At least 5 documented series have reported on this case and have been aired on French television. French broadcaster TF1 produced a drama series inspired by the events. While the storyline is fictional, it's based on the DuPont family as well as that of the John List. The plot revolves around a man, Thomas Kurtz, his wife, Alice, and their 8-year-old son, Romain, in an ordinary family whose lives are turned upside down when the police suspect that Thomas is living under a false identity and is actually someone else, a man suspected of murdering his family 15 years earlier before going on the run and not being seen since. Thomas is brought under investigation by the police and goes about trying to prove his innocence, both the police and his family. Filming for the series consisted of 2 45-minute episodes, took place in December of 2018, and the series was aired in September of 2019. In 2020, Netflix resurrected the Unsolved Mysteries series, and the DuPont de Leganese murders were investigated in the third episode called House of Horrors. And that's what sparked my interest in the case, was that Unsolved Mysteries episode. And wanting to find out more about it. But that's where it sits. That's the end of the Wikipedia entry. There isn't a discovered section. There isn't a finality. This is still out there where maybe you can solve a mystery. What makes me wonder is if these folks are in fact in the Witness Protection Relocation Program and are in the U.S. as farmers in Iowa or wherever it is. It makes you wonder if they're sitting there and just cringing every time a television investigation comes out about this, a miniseries comes out about it, a podcaster talks about it like us. It just, you know, if they're trying to stay on the DL, it doesn't help when so much information has come out about this case and still not knowing what's going on. I mean, we're talking 10 years since their disappearance. So the whole... I understand the family being alarmed. I think the family kind of gave it some time. They had their couple years where not a lot was said, and we're talking 10 years now. I would be wondering too. I'd be going, was this really the case? Were they really relocated? or did something else happen? Where do you think it all sits?
Well, for one, I'm thankful that I'm not in a position that I have to make any of those calls. I like to think, and again, knowing nothing about the situation, I would like to think that with all of the new attention and people talking about it, that if there is some type of government witness protection program, that there would be some communication to the family. Mm-hmm. Because I would believe that clearly they're not going to make a statement for the public or any large group or gathering, but some type, even if it's encrypted in some way, where the family can have that closure and they understand that they may never be able to see them again, but at least they know more than dot, dot, dot right now. So that's my thought on it. And the fact that so much time has gone by and there hasn't been any type of communication, I will side with the elusiveness, and he is he's somewhere out there, or he has since taken his own life, or somebody. That's my thought. Opposed to if you had a, is which one is it?
I,
is it for this or that? What's your take?
Here's my take on it. I don't think he killed them. I think that there is some semblance of this happening, of them coming to the U.S. with the witness protection program. And I have two, I think there's two roads that could go off from there. Either A, what you just described has actually happened, but the family, because they love and respect their family members, haven't said shit about it. They were told to shut up and don't go to the press, don't say anything more about it. Or if you do get questioned, just keep playing it as a mystery. And that's it. Because I don't think we're going to know. If the family found out, if the government somehow said, okay, look, yes, we will tell your family that you're okay, but they can't tell other people that you're okay. And if they ever do, we're never communicating with them again, and neither are you. And so maybe that was presented that way of like, look, they're fine. They have to stay in hiding longer, but they are okay. Or they got over here and something happened and they were found here by whoever was, you know, a threat to them there, and they've disappeared from here. Obviously the government would know about that, but if it's part of some sort of larger ongoing case, we wouldn't necessarily know about that part. So I don't know. I'm leading to think that there's a lot of confusion here on purpose. And I'm wondering if, you know, it's going to turn up that if it ever does turn up that these guys are, you know, neighbors to somebody in Paducah, Kentucky, and you had no idea. Stranger things have indeed happened. I don't think they're dead. My guess is that they are hiding, and it remains a mystery. And I'm thinking they're sitting there cringing every time people are bringing this up, going, "Hey, what happened to them?" Because it just that brings that many more people going, "Is that the guy I saw last week at the Safeway?" You know, it just doesn't bode well for them. But I don't know. It is certainly a very twisted mystery, one you can almost not make up because there's so many twists and turns to it.
So really, when you're listening to this and you think you're having a bad day or maybe a bad life, hey, at least you're not in the witness protection program and people keep talking about you and you have to try to become even more inconspicuous, more anonymous than you already are.
Yeah, I think that's something we can all look at and go, at least I'm not dealing with that shit right now. With all the other shit we're all dealing with, at least we're not dealing with that shit on top of everything else. Very interesting story. I think I might actually sit down and watch the Unsolved Mysteries or read the Unsolved Mysteries episode because it is all subtitles. I will warn you if you want to go check it out. Very interesting mystery. Maybe you too can solve a mystery. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, press subscribe wherever it is you download podcasts. Leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts as well. That helps us tremendously in the rankings and letting other folks know that we exist. We're a 2-day a week show now. Every single Tuesday and Thursdays, new episodes of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Be sure to download and enjoy. Until next time, for Sean, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side
of Wikipedia.